And finally this week, they are back. Doctors Aaron Carroll and Rachel Vreeman have teamed up for their third book, Busting Medical Myths. And this time, they've taken on myths about sex in a book called Don't Put That In There. And I should tell you, our conversation is PG-rated, but if you have delicate ears nearby, you might want to suggest they go watch a video for a few minutes. Dr. Aaron Carroll, Dr. Rachel Vreeman, congratulations on your new myth-busting book. This one is about sex.
Yes, it is.
And so what I try to do is I try to pick some that, you know, it would be easy to talk about on public radio.
Okay.
So let's see how this goes. Men want it more, way, way more. I think everyone has heard that men think of sex every 7 seconds, which... is impressive, isn't it, Rachel?
Well, it's an impressive number, and in fact, it's pretty much impossible. If you were thinking about sex every 7 seconds, that's really as much as you're breathing most of the time. And while, you know, people do think about sex, and in fact, statistics would suggest that over half of men think about sex at least once a day or even several times a day, it doesn't come anywhere close to every 7 seconds.
Well, have they ever measured how often women think of sex?
Absolutely. And while statistics do report slightly lower percentages in terms of how often they're thinking of it, it's not nearly as different as you might think.
Okay, next one. Let's talk about aphrodisiacs.
Okay.
Oysters.
Yes.
Chocolates. Bananas.
Well, there's lots of myths and lots of things that people will say that, you know, things will make it more likely for them to be aroused. And part of it is got to be some kind of placebo effect. I mean, you know, the idea that if you think you're going to be more aroused, you might absolutely happen. And that's often what people will say is this works for me. And that's great if it works for you. And it's great if it were, you think it works for other people. But what they're really getting at is if I gave this to somebody else and they weren't already predisposed to becoming more aroused, would this make it more likely that they would? So could I get a gain from somebody else, theoretically? And
origins.
That never works. Never, 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 ever works. Never, ever, ever
so,
works.
So what origins of this? I mean, why well, with oysters?
The, with the
why
oysters,
chocolate?
And this is where public radio is going to get a little sketchy, but with the oysters, the belief is that part of it is visual, that the oyster in some way looks perhaps like female genitalia. Some of it has to do with taste, that the salty taste could somehow also be likened to tasting bodily fluids in some way. And so there is some thought with oysters. With the other things, there are some people that believe like chocolate somehow stimulates endorphins or releases other chemicals in the brain, which somehow have something to do with also the pleasure centers that would also be related to sex. But these are all theoretical where we're trying to explain what people have already decided is truth. And when we look at just the truth before that, there's no evidence and no studies that show if we sort of double blind or give people this and they don't know about, are they more likely to come aroused? The answer to that is no.
All right. All right, Rachel. You shouldn't have sex before a big game.
Well, this seems to be a really common idea. People have a lot of rules about what their athletes should be doing before a big game or how you should prepare before a big competition. And yet a lot of the ideas for why you should be abstaining are just not true. First of all, the average encounter takes far, far less energy than people might think. In fact, if you look at the cardiovascular exertion and amount of calories burned, it's about the equivalent to climbing 2 sets of stairs. And no one would say that an athlete should, you know, make sure they don't walk up the stairs before a big game. Another worry is that it will somehow use up your testosterone, or that it's a better thing if you let that frustration or testosterone or energy build up, because then you might be, you know, performing better next time. Maybe you'd be more aggressive in your game or whatever. The truth is actually on the other side of that. A study actually suggests that testosterone levels are higher for men who have engaged in sexual activity the night before than they were for those who didn't. So if somehow that testosterone boost is helping you, it's only going to help you if you were actually involved rather than if you abstained. Now, the one thing where this could come into play is if in your encounter it's extremely emotionally exhausting, or, you know, if it's really something that's creating psychological tension or throwing you off in terms of your mental state in that way, it's certainly possible that that kind of distraction could be bad for you. On the other hand, if it's something that helps you relax and get in a better frame of mind or is part of your normal activity, it might have the opposite effect.
You know, another one that's just pervasive is if you want a baby boy, you do this. If you want a baby girl, you do this. You go to a vacation in a warmer climate or a colder climate.
Yeah, well, I think that everything works about 50% of the time. And so this is one of those. What's awesome about this myth is that I think if you ask people which of these activities produces a boy or a girl, they're almost always sure that they know what the correct answer is, but they almost don't always give you the exact answer.
Right.
They're sure that this position will give you a girl. Yes, other people are sure that that same position gives you a boy. If you talk to them about if you have sex early or you know, long before ovulation, well, some people will say, well, the sperm that are males are nimbler and faster. So therefore, you know, if you have sex at certain times, the men with the boy sperm will get there first. Then they'll say,
it's always the first, isn't it?
Other people say, but the boy sperm are less hardy. So therefore, you have it at different times of the month. The boy sperm won't get there first. The girl sperm will get there first. And it's all irrelevant. Nothing has ever been shown in any studies at all to be able to predict or make the sex of one shot over the other more likely. If that was the case, we'd all know and people would be doing it. But the truth of the matter, again, is everything works perfectly about 50% of the time. And we just have no way to make this go one way or the other.
All right, Dr. Rachel Freeman. Dr. Aaron Carroll had confessed that he believed in that 10-year difference in sexual peaking. Any of the myths in this book that you believed at one time?
Well, certainly there are plenty that I believed, I have to say. The idea of don't leave your socks on. So,
yes.
Of course, it seems like it would be such a lame thing
that
to
one
do,
I
right?
Hadn't
like if you
heard. I have to admit,
oh,
that's
really?
A new one on me. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a whole, the whole phrase would be like, knock your socks off, right? You should, you know, if it's going to be pretty sad if you're there in your pajamas or socks or whatever. And yet, there's, interestingly enough, a study that actually looks at orgasms in men and women that suggested that there might be a good reason to leave your socks on or the equivalent, something that makes you comfortable. The study was really interesting because they actually were looking at people's brain activities while they were with a partner trying to stimulate them to orgasm. And apparently it was very cold in the room where they were doing these scans. And a lot of people were complaining about cold feet. So as part of this, as it happened, they started to offer people socks or not offer them socks. And that became part of their study. And they actually found that 80% of the participants who were offered socks were able to have orgasms, whereas only 50% of those without socks were able to do so, suggesting that people who were more comfortable, who had warm feet, were more able to have orgasms. The interesting part of the study is they were looking at how different parts of the brain were functioning while they were trying to come to a sexual climax. And interestingly enough, it seemed to be connected that, first of all, that if you were more comfortable, you were more able to come to orgasm. And this seemed particularly true for women, that women were more likely to be able to have orgasms if other parts of their brain centers, the parts that might be, say, anxious about something or worrying about something else or thinking about other things, those centers needed to be essentially deactivated or disengaged from for them to be able to have orgasms.
And then, of course, that's where the socks come in.
Exactly. So if it makes you comfortable, fine, go for the socks.
But that one's a great one because I just assumed that there was no difference, that like the when we dispelled the myth that we would just find that there was no difference.
Well, and it goes
turns
in
out the opposite direction is true.
Exactly.
That's what's sort of amazing about that is
agreed.
It's not just that wearing the socks makes no difference. It turns out making the socks might actually help.
Right.
Okay, well, I picked all the ones I was interested in, and there's plenty more. Any that I didn't ask you about that are just your favorites?
You know, you can never go wrong with how large are men's penises or what's the average penis size one. You know, it's funny because I feel like
one.
We've written this chapter multiple times and it never, ever gets old enough. It's just
this is in another book or is that what you're
well,
saying?
Well, we wrote, this was
right,
actually, I think, the first chapter of our first, we expanded
it. No, it was hands, that was foot size.
No, that was hands and foot size. Right, yeah. But people are consumed with penis size. We should just leave it at that. Men and women seem to be very obsessed with it. But it always amazes me that when you look at the studies where men self-report,
amazes.
Their penises are much larger than when someone actually goes and checks. And then I'm always amazed that they actually do studies where people go and check. But they do happen with tons and tons and tons of men. And it always seems to be the same thing, that when they're actually having somebody else check, that the size is a little bit less.
Oh, and does it matter?
No. Well, yeah. It's like that's such
science,
a, that is,
Barbara.
Yeah, that's mixed science. That's a jaded question. Does it matter just in the sense that, like, you know, is there a linear relationship between size and happiness? Absolutely not.
Well, and one of the interesting things with that is that many more men report being dissatisfied with their penis size than women report being dissatisfied with their partner's penis size. Essentially, the women are fine with it, but the men are really concerned that somehow they're not matching up.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. And I think that this is, you know, it sort of goes to show that this is one of those where I think men have created the problem and continue to pay the price for it. I don't think this is necessarily being driven by women.
Dr. Erin Carroll and Dr. Rachel Vreeman, author of Don't Put That In There, your latest book about debunking myths. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Erin Carroll and Dr. Rachel Vreeman. This is their third book together. We'll post links to the conversations about books 1 and 2 on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org.